Welcome to the Mentoris Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. Our guest today is Robert Barbera, the author of Building Wealth 101, where he offers up his advice about how to make your own wealth. Welcome, Robert.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, please. I'm so excited to talk about all of this. And I'm going to begin with the question that I think everyone starts with, which is, how do you define wealth?
Wealth to me is a combination. It's a combination of what you do and what your actions or your devotion is to what sense of achievement that you want to pursue. In my mind, the most important thing to start off with is have good health habits. I do believe that a healthy person thrives so much better, obviously, than a sick person. And I believe in the context of good health practices to avoid the kinds of things that that would take your health down for one way or another. And then the second part is to set yourself a goal to achieve success in the field of your endeavor. And that could not only be money, it could be in a sense of achieving or providing for others. It could be a sense of accomplishment or an invention. It's so many things. That to me, wealth is misunderstood to mean money, and it's not about money. It could be about money, but there's so many other values in life. And in order to do this, you have to have the health that goes with it, and then the ambition and integrity to pursue that.
That's beautiful. Now, I know we've talked in the past, and it interests me because my grandparents were from Sicily, and they would have thought that wealth simply meant enough money to buy their own home and live there and take care of themselves all their lives. So how does that change in your mind, and how were you trained as a child to think about wealth?
Well, in my family structure, it was very conflicted. My mom and dad were somewhat opposites, where my dad would be very happy just smoking a cigarette, drinking wine, and listening to an opera on a recorder. My mother had a different sense of achievement, and that was to acquire a property. Having come from so much poverty that it was the way or the thing to do about creating wealth. So there I was in the mix between my mom and dad, and I try in my own mind over the years to satisfy both ends of the spectrum of what wealth was and how my parents respected the value of life.
That's so beautiful. It seems to have worked, obviously, or you would not have an entire book explaining how to do this to other people.
Yes.
That's lovely. So let's think about some of the lessons that you've learned along the way. One of the first ones that you mentioned in the book, which seems basic, learning to budget is clearly important, but how do you create a budget that you can stick to?
To establish a budget, you have to start where you are. And incidentally, that where you are continually changes. But at least in establishing the budget, where you are amounts to what income you have from any source whatsoever. And then the second part is to make a survey of the expenses that you've been making for the last 6 months, 8 months, or a year. And it's not that difficult if you go through a bank book or go through what you already know to establish those. And from that, you then are able to see your pattern of spending and your pattern of income. From that, you then prepare a goal in order to how you're going to move from one direction to another. In order to do that, you have to have a purpose, what you have in mind, and what you want to achieve. Everyone will look at that in a different way. And I was working in the government for years and years, and I noticed a lot of people were living from hand to mouth, and that satisfied them. So their only purpose was to take care of the day-to-day situation to go with that. I had a different mindset on that. I wanted to achieve material items for the sake of investing so that the long-range approach is entirely different for the budget. So whatever makes someone satisfied that they're satisfied in what they're doing and how they're doing it, fine. If there's a sense of achievement or purpose, then you decide how the budget can work. So in the budget, going back to income, you set up steps in order to figure out how much more you want to earn or receive in one way or another, and that becomes part of your goals now with the budget. So the budget then is your personality built into the paperwork of where you are and then what you want to achieve. If you find out that you're breaking even, it just seems that that is your limitation of your purpose in your budget. If you want to achieve something beyond your budget, then the budget has to establish, and you have to force yourself to write this down, because writing it down is like signing your name to a contract. And so in this budget, your expenses are evaluated as to how much you want to end up with. Now, in my case, it sounds awfully extreme, but when I was living in the South, I really was satisfied to live on 50% of what I was making, and the other 50% went in investments. And that was very easy to achieve because I was making Northeastern income and Southeastern expenses. So I took advantage of that. Intuitively, I kept the budget. I'm saying the whole trick, Robert, is to spend less, and so therefore you end up saving more. And so part of that budget and the interest of that budget is, if you're then trying to achieve beyond where you are now, that you have to leave a plus in the column as to how much you end up with. It's always been the case that the real monies that you can put aside is by spending less. That sounds awful easy, but you have to work yourself into that mentality and make yourself a promise that in this budget, it has a purpose. The budget itself, then, is something that you do every month, and you have to evaluate that budget to see if you're having set a goal, whether you are. Now, it's been my experience that many people, as soon as they have more income, spend more money. And the irony of that is that there's no end to spending, but the income may be limited. So it's a lot easier not keeping a budget to realize that you're running into a hole.
That's brilliant. That's so brilliant. It seems to me that what we're also talking about here is having the ability, one, to be motivated, and two, to make sacrifices in the present for the future.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
We're not used to that all the time.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. This, again, seems an easy thing, but how does one avoid credit card debt? That's how we pay for everything these days.
Well, that is the morphine or the sugar or the drug that is in society. We find it buying something that costs more than what we have to simply get a credit card, and there's some fallacies built into that. One is that what you're buying with the credit card has an inherent interest rate and an expense, so you're actually paying more for the product than had you saved the money. So the idea is, if you want something bad enough, why not just save for it and then buy it? And that does two things. It allows you to really decide whether you really want it enough, and then whether you don't have to interfere with your budget to be able to buy it, where you would have to pay more money for the credit card purposes. That's why credit cards are out there. They're out there. It's a business within a business to put a person in debt. And that particular debt is really a weight on your back. And you get used to that credit card, and you think that's the system of life. And as the new generations come into, for the last, 40 years of credit cards, has actually damaged society. And it makes everyone pressured to keep up with the neighbors and buying things. And it's not a positive. It's definitely a negative. And I honestly wish that a credit card wasn't there. But this is not to say bank loans and sensible buying and a legitimate loan for a purpose has far more value than being in debt all the time.
That's fascinating. It reminds me of a phrase that I've heard a lot, which is knowing the difference between what you need and what you want.
Yes.
And you're also reminding me that when I was younger, I remember there was a thing called layaway, which I've seen come back in a few stores, where you did lay away the money each month, and then the store gave you that thing, as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no interest.
Not a bad system.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, excellent, excellent. I think that's great advice. So you mentioned the concept of paying for college. So how does one do this in a financially responsible way, and how did you do that?
I believe what has happened is that the government loans have provided money, and it would seem to be good. But what I have also seen is that the government providing more money allows the college to charge more and keep the students in college longer with the notion that the money is available and it's a Koch loan. I've noticed in my business, in the applications that people give me, they're in debt so much after a college they can't buy a house. They're strangled with whatever they want to do, and they accept this as a system. They think in terms that the college loan was a grant of some kind, and this is what you do, so everyone kind of falls in line. What bothers me about that is the very notion that parents are not providing for college from the day that the child is born. And I don't care if it's $1 or $10 or $100 a day or a week or a month, that the involvement of the parent is not in the picture to provide money. So I see kids wanting to go to college and the parent hasn't provided for them. That to me is very poor parental responsibility. And it isn't so much that they don't pay for them, they don't even think of trying to pay for them. And then when they have this debt, it's not as though they become serious students, because they just think it's part of the game to go leave high school and go into college. In my case, I went to college for maybe 5 years evening time and worked during the day. And then I must admit I was very fortunate, because my wife says, "Robert, you go to school full time and I'll take care of the expenses." And I says, "Well, if you're willing to do that, I will show you how two can live as one." And I actually did, because I monitored her budget before we got married. And I said, "That amount of money that you make and that you're living on, I will show you how the two of us can living on. After all, a can of beans is a can of beans, and we can split the can." And that's what we did. And I was the one that shopped for the food to make sure I could live up to that budget. We made sure that we got into a good rental situation where it was very affordable. And you do these kinds of things. When you do that, then you appreciate college so much more. You have a purpose of graduating to go for your career. You feel like you've taken on the responsibility, and you don't pressure your parents to have to afford you to go to college. It's something that you do. It's something you earn, and so I think you're a better student for it.
I've seen that true many cases. It's an interesting story, because we see people do better after college, but they need a better way to get through. And it's true, colleges have, the prices have gone up and up and up. So
yeah,
that's a difficulty.
Yeah,
I see often. So of course you recommend to people that they start their own business. You were just discussing having a quote unquote regular job, and then you somehow then also did start your own business on the side. How does a person start a business, and how does a person figure out what business they would be good at?
I believe that it doesn't really matter what business you're in. Some do better than others, obviously. Some is because of certain timing where something is doing so well and others aren't. But the business has to be your personality. I don't see where you should be getting into a business because it pays well in of itself, that's how you decide to be in that business. I think you should understand that you're good at it, or reasonably good at it, and that is something that you like and something that you can see yourself doing for a number of years. And a lot of that is the personality. And it doesn't matter in the context of a business. It's the difference between working for yourself and doing your own thing, or being supervised or have supervised always pushing you along or monitoring yet. So Being business, it took me a long time to realize that my individual personality needed to be self-employed. So even while I was full employed, I found so many different areas I could earn extra money to be in business. And opportunities are everywhere to be in business. One day a friend called up and he said a truckload of art had come from Italy and it's being auctioned off. He says, are you interested? I says, yeah, I'll go down there. And I picked up these art pieces for about $10 and I was able to sell them for $90. And how did I do that? I had no idea how to sell art. So I went to art dealers and I said, here, I'll put this on consignment. We'll split the $90. You'll get 45 and I'll get 45. I pay 10 or 20. So I'm doubling my money and you're doubling your money. So then another friend one time called me up to work with some liquor. So then I did the same kind of thing again. I offered liquor to people that were having parties. I knew the party was coming up or a wedding coming up. So I picked up the liquor. I had a deal with the liquor. And, you know, these things just keep on coming. It's like daisies coming out of the ground because it's all there. It's opportunity. Opportunity is everywhere. And when someone says to me they don't know what to do, I says, well, then just do something. And you'll be amazed at how it becomes an infection to want to do something. It's a real sense of achievement. So my whole game was to have a full-time job, guarantee income. I worked for government over 14 years, and I actually always had a job after my government work during the day to pursue it in the afternoon, evening, rather, on or over at weekends. And I enjoyed myself so much more because I was making over and above, and that was the money being put aside. So that made the difference.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I love the idea that people have to be open and comfortable when opportunity shows up to take a chance.
Absolutely. Yeah. Always have a sense of comfort that something that is steady and positive working for you. So the other part that you do, it doesn't have the sense of a risk. It has the sense of opportunity. And so you don't go into a business unless you truly learn about it. And it's best to start from the earliest possible position in that business and then develop all the background necessary. I have had terrible insight into people that come to money through inheritance. It doesn't last that way. Or even in a divorce, it doesn't come that way if one partner made the money but someone else received it because of the divorce situation. So to me, it's important to start very, very, very small and then build up as you go. In my case, I just love the idea of providing shelter for people. It's one of the necessities of life. Like food, shelter is important. And I felt, well, I would be going into a business that provided shelter, which was rental income. And I had some experience from my parents who had a property and rental income. So it was natural to pursue that very area. And you also have to watch out where your parents come home complaining, and then you have to realize that's just letting out steam. The fact is, they're really satisfied with it, but what they only talk about is the hardship of it. And there is nothing that doesn't have a hardship. There's nothing that doesn't give you a problem or a situation that you have to overcome. But what I started out by saying, it's something that you have to like. And if you don't like it, then what is in that head of yours? You know.
But I love that you talked about the idea that renting to people is offering them a home, a place to live, which everyone does need. And it's something that we want. It's warm. It's personable. Right. I think that's beautiful. And of course, it leads us into the concept. Another of your concepts is that a person should invest in buying their own home as opposed to renting long term. Right. It's a good thing to get started in life, but you're supposed to, in the end, buy a place because obviously, real estate goes up in value.
Yes, buying a home has become an investment. It's just not the security of a home or something that you own, a sense of pride. It has, for a good number of years, been an investment. So it has many aspects to it. And also, that wealth that you develop, the equity as you're reducing the mortgage or the trust deed on the property as it reduces your building wealth. Meanwhile, you have the appreciation of the property going up, and even if it's inflationary consequence, it's still a heck of an advantage. You can also turn over that home and then reinvest and keep moving that as a form of investment. So it's territory, it's value, and it gives you responsibility. And, you know, with a renter, it has a place and time, and properties do go up too much. And just recently, I allowed someone to use their pension to buy a home. But you see, the other part of it is it's timing. And so I tried to warn the dear lady, your timing is off. Houses are far too high. Stay where you are. Pay the rent. Because there are times in the timing that rent is a better deal than house. And you should take the difference and save it. And you come out so much better. And just wait for the time, because it does fluctuate, and you should be aware of the cycle. And it's not easy to figure that out, but on a long range of several years, you can figure out the cycle. And that's what you also have to contend with.
So the other thing you're speaking to is that before making any investment, a person has to do their research into what it is they're thinking of.
That's right. Yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me. And that leads us into this concept of having investments above and beyond the place that you live, or, you know, if you had a couple of properties. What other things do you think are worthwhile for people to invest in? And how do you decide the balance in, I hear a lot of people talking about, I want to invest in companies I believe in, or do I want to invest in companies that make a lot of money? How do you decide how to diversify that?
It also depends on how much money you have to invest. And obviously, that's where the savings account starts you off. And so the first investment is to actually create a sense of wealth through a savings account and try to get the best savings account there is. Here again, everything I'm saying is timing, because I've seen over the years how it changed, where when I started out, a savings account would earn 5.5%, and now you're lucky to get 1%. So saving back then was prudent. I didn't have the notion of what to invest in, but I just knew that developing a certain nest egg would be important to get started. In this time, even though you get 1.5% or whatever, you still need the nest egg. You still need the savings. And then how do you decide what you're going to invest in? Here again, we get back to the type of risk that you're in and the age that you're in. At an early age, I see the opportunity for high risk, because you can always start again. You have the period in your life where you can start again and then develop from there. Getting started again at an early age, you start to sharpen your mind as to what is a good investment, what doesn't work, what was programmed and what was being sold, whether it was really good or not. So you start to learn how to evaluate something that is worthwhile investment and something that is very much a risk. So when you start getting past a certain point that you've saved enough and you've started some risk ventures and knowing how to evaluate those, then you start to get into the kinds of investments that will be balanced in your life. So then you take the risk and you take the conservative. I've always explained to myself that I always invested with one foot on land and the other foot on the banana. I always knew that if I lost something on the type risk, maybe 10% of my wealth, that it didn't matter. When you go so far as to whether it matters and you lose, that was a serious mistake, and you're always out and never get back in again. So you have to be able to say, if I lost that portion, would I stop my thrust on investing and creating? And the timing is such that some things are doing so well in the economy. And as an example, we've had these ups and downs in the economy that have really destroyed a lot of wealth and families. and then others succeeded by being in the right timing of it. Much of that, some of that is manipulated through the people out in the world and how they invest. Some of the richest people in 1929 got out of the stock market before it blew up.
Right.
And the other poor people lost everything they had. And so there's always timing and knowing that things are a balloon and they balloon up to a certain point or peak that sooner or later they're going to buy. So it might have been Rockefeller or Morgan that said when the shoeshine kid told him about the stock market, he knew it was time to get out. So, yeah, it's a funny thing. Unfortunately, when the crowd gets in, it's already too late. And so your timing, again, is important to be into something that you can see growing. And here we are in this particular year, and everything seems to be high, but borrowing is very low. So you want to be in there. You want to structure something, but you want to be careful on what it is, and you want to know that the risk isn't too great and the possibility is overstated. And so it's careful.
Being careful is always a good thing.
Yeah.
One of my last questions, I have a couple more. And one of them is, all of this planning and all the stuff that you've learned and you've put together, how then do you blend that when you're in a relationship, when you're in a marriage with someone? How do you make sure that you're both on the same page about making these decisions?
It's not easy. I've been lucky twice. My first wife of 45 years of marriage, she was the one that allowed me to pay for me for going to college. Tremendously indebted. And she came from a very, very poor circumstance, to say the least. She was programmed, wittingly or unwittingly, of what my goal was. It takes time. I was lucky there to find a kind of a person that went along with my goals. I think that, and I don't know about where kids are now, but I think the relationship of a fiancé relationship of courting is the opportunity for either party to say what they expect. It's that kind of thing that they work together as a partnership and they help one another, but not necessarily on the day-to-day activities necessarily, but in the concept. So when you say, well, we want to have six children, well, then you got to make sure that that's what both parties want. when you say that you want to live in a certain town or a certain thing, those things during those periods have to be said. I instinctively explain those things to my first wife, what I want to achieve, and she had no problem understanding that. She had no problem helping me. And she worked in her territory, and what she could do well was keeping the records, and I did well in negotiating, arbitrating, and all those other things, and in the maintenance. So we worked a partnership. And it's so important to each have their own territory as to what they want to do and leave the other one alone. Yeah, that's important. And then I remarried, and we have different backgrounds insofar as business, but we also respected each other's territory. And you have to truly be honest. I think the problem with couples along the way is to put on a show and put on a face that they're not. And that's dangerous. And it's, sooner or later, it's going to cause disruption. You see, to me, I don't know if I'm preaching now, but when you marry, you promise. Keep your promise, but make sure that this is what you promise. And then I think the good times and the bad times all mellow out.
I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. It's about a partnership, and it is about the communication ahead of time, so you're not taken by surprise.
That's right.
That's so beautiful. Well, my final question in all these interviews is the one that interests us at Mentoris so much, which is, who do you think were the mentors in your life?
I used to struggle over that, and because I had two parents that had two different points of view, I tried to emulate both of them. It couldn't be done. I just had to go with my mother, who was the positive person in my life. And by example, I followed that, and that was my mentor. No question, I had a great dad. I had a great brother. And as an example, my brother and I, he was an academician, and he was a PhD, and he was brilliant at what he did. And he was nice enough to tell me, Robert, you go your way and I go my way. And so that was a very nice thing. He was a mentor by privilege. Then I ran into some people over the years who were very, gave me a sense of gratitude by giving. When you have all this acquisition of wealth, then you have to do something about it. And I didn't want to have the sense of greed in my mind that I acquired this wealth for the sense of greed. So it was very reassuring that someone would come along as a mentor to show me how to volunteer my money. That's something that is another richness of life. It's another wealth of life to be able to volunteer, to be able to give. And so I picked that up. So I've had these mentors. I try to look at people I appreciate and are really the right person, whether it's a religious concept, a wealth concept, a personality concept. So I kind of pick and choose, but my mom was certainly at the top. I mean, if there's anyone that deserves the credit for teaching, without teaching, but only by example, that she became my mentor more than ever.
That's so beautiful. I would say the same thing about my own mother, so there. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing to say.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Robert, thank you so much. This has been a very enlightening conversation. I think I learned a lot, and I know that folks who listen will learn as well.
Good. I'm glad you had me.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.